Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago this month, On Point went to Shanghai. 12 months and one massive global economic crisis later, we're turning our microphones back to China today and asking some of the same big thinkers we sat down with in Shanghai to give us a 2009 update. Is China still rising? And how do they see a world in which so many nations, including the United States, are weakened and China sits on a mountain of foreign exchange, U.S. dollars? This hour on Point, 1 year on, we look back to China. You can join the conversation after earthquake and Olympics and economic meltdown. How do you see China now? Still on the rise, on a sidetrack, treasury to the world, partner, or something else? We will hear in a moment from two big Chinese thinkers who talked with us last year in Shanghai. But joining me first is Anthony Kuhn, NPR correspondent in China. Anthony Kuhn, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
You know very well that we were in China about a year ago now. You were very helpful when we were there, and we thank you for that. Then help us look back over this year, Anthony. Earthquake, Olympics, economic meltdown. I guess my first question would be, we felt, in spite of the fact that there were early all kinds of signs of economic trouble last year, we felt this enormous boom sensibility still in China. Is that still on, that big confidence, big head of steam roaring into the future?
In the long term, yes, but I think the blow of the financial crisis has changed everything, and it's clear that how business has been going for the past 20 or 30 years has now got to change. There is a confident side to that. If you look at the way the G20 was going, the pronouncements that China was making, saying that, you know, the U.S. dollar was done for as a reserve currency and we had to go on to an international one, saying to the U.S., you know, careful with our hundreds of billions of dollars worth of treasury bonds, all that money that the U.S. owes. And also lecturing tones and saying, you know, we Confucians here like to save money while you Americans spend beyond your means. I think that people see that in different ways. I mean, I think people now know that the relationship, the economic relationship with the U.S. was symbiotic, but at the same time unsustainable, and that when China depressed its currency to export us all those things, that means they were making less money than they should from their exports, and they were paying more than they should for their imports.
And they were accumulating all those vast foreign exchange reserves, $2 trillion or something, maybe half of that in dollars.
That's right. And now they're stuck with it, and they're at the mercy of the U.S. Federal Reserve, which, you know, if it prints too much money and goes on a spending spree, inflation could really eat away at all those U.S. Treasury bonds. So they're in a very sensitive spot. It's not all strong, not all upside at all.
With the time that has passed, give us a couple of bottom lines here. I know these are both complex, but first of all, when the Chinese look back on the earthquake that hit Sichuan almost a year ago, it was May of last year, just after we departed, what appears to have been the national takeaway from that quake, the government's response, that whole enormous event, Anthony?
Well, you remember, Tom, when you guys were here, we were right in the middle of that very angry period after disruptions of the Olympic torch relay accusations that the Western media were distorting the Tibet issue. And all of a sudden, this earthquake happened and completely changed everybody's focus. All this anger was immediately changed and diverted. And for a lot of people who grew up, during the 80s and 90s, times, particularly in the cities, times were fairly affluent, fairly stable. And this thing really opened their eyes to suffering and, you know, some of the more backward parts of the country. And some of the good things that came from it were, of course, an outpouring of charity and a building of civil society. Mm-hmm. But one of the big problems was the children who died in their schoolrooms when the schoolhouses collapsed on them. And the parents say that that was because of corruption and shoddy construction. And now the names of those children have essentially become a state secret, and it's become a no-go zone, a political minefield like Tiananmen, like the Cultural Revolution.
We may be talking more about that as the actual anniversary approaches. What about the Olympics? All around the world, people's eyes just popped at those images that came out, the opening ceremony with those big fields of drummers absolutely in unison banging away and all the enormous facilities that China had put up. We've seen it from afar, but inside China itself, what's the kind of bottom line there, Anthony, on how the Chinese look back on that event? Did it do what they hoped?
I think for most people, yes, it did. You know, this had been the focus of public life for several years running up to the games. And, you know, I think most people feel that they got their moment in the sun the way they wanted. And I think the calculation that sports would eclipse issues of politics and pollution that dominated in the media in the run-up, I think that bet pretty much paid off. And, you know, the Michael Phelps and the Usain Bolts pretty much captured the attention, as did all the, you know, the swarms of smiling volunteers. But, you know, first of all, we had this uncomfortable period in the run-up. You guys remember all the I think it was, you know, China getting used to the glare of international attention.
Yeah.
You remember that business about CNN and Jack Cafferty's disparaging comments about China.
And fury from some Chinese about what they saw as rough handling in the run-up to the Olympics by the international community.
Yeah, well, they were sort of saying, how could such a reputable and famous institution, a journalistic outfit such as CNN, have such, you know, biased and inflammatory comment? Well, welcome to the business.
Right.
And then afterwards, you know, there was this other big incident. It was the melamine tainted milk scandal, mm-hmm. which killed six Chinese and made 300,000 sick. And aside from just the, you know, basically the killing for profit that Chinese people saw in this, they also realized very clearly from the media that the reason this thing got so out of control was that there was a ban on bad news running up to the Olympics. And just sort of like the SARS epidemic before, you know, the media were not allowed to discuss this problem. And so the thing just snowballed.
And Anthony Kuhn, and finally, just coming right off this last weekend, the G20 meeting, China's leader there with the leaders from around the world, did China feel like it got the face, the status that it deserves in these times with its you know, current standing?
Yes, I think people generally feel that, you know, soft power is about respect, and this is what the country has been pushing. And I think the media have made it clear that China is now very much the focus of expectations, of attention. But there's still a lot of unease because, you know, the economic crisis has not bottomed out. And 20 million people have lost jobs in China, and so they're waiting for the shoe to fall. People are still very nervous about it.
Anthony Kuhn, Beijing correspondent for NPR. Anthony, always great to be with you. Thanks for your help last year, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And now, two of the many voices we heard last April in China. Joining us now from Beijing is Sun Che. He's professor at the Institute for International Studies and director of the Center for U.S.-China Relations at Tsinghua University in Beijing. He's one of China's leading scholars on U.S.-China relations, a wise voice last year with us in Shanghai. Sun Che, thank you very much for joining us again.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Very well, and it's lovely to hear your voice. Thanks for being there. And with us from Shanghai is Fang Shenghai, Director General in the Office for Financial Services in the Shanghai Metropolitan Government, former Deputy CEO of the Shanghai Stock Exchange, a U.S.-educated mover and shaker in the Chinese Communist Party, who joined us last year in Shanghai. Fang Shenghai, it's great to talk with you again as well. Thank you so much for being there.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here again.
Sun Che, first to you. We've had 1 year. Things were riding high. There have been huge events, earthquake, Olympics, and meltdown in the time since last year. What about China's rise? Is it still on, or is it on pause, Sun Che?
I think, as you said, we have see the Olympic, we have see the recent developments of U.S.-China relations and Chinese foreign policy is also outreached into the world. And I hosted Hillary's visit in Beijing. So we see a lot of change in the past year. I think the current focus, either domestic or internationally, China is very much concerned about this global recession. And also, as you just mentioned, we have over-invested in the United States. The Chinese Prime Minister has emphasized that we care about the safety of these the Chinese asset in the United States. So a lot of things I think we need to be discussed.
Feng Xinghai, many countries have been weakened by the economic downturn. Has that made China relatively stronger, or has China been equally hit?
Well, first of all, we do not have a financial crisis inside China. Mm. And our financial system is healthy. Our banks are doing extremely well. The Chinese economy, however, is affected by a dramatic slowdown of exports, which, of course, was caused by the financial crisis in the world. And now, are we relatively stronger compared to some other countries? To some extent, it is, because our growth rate is still about, 6, 7, 8%, mm-hmm. whereas the other countries are having negative growth. But we have certainly been affected by the international slowdown very much. You know, there's a lot of overcapacities inside China now because these capacities were built for exports, and now exports are gone. And you mentioned, Anthony mentioned that there's 20 million people, migrant workers, that have been laid off. So we are facing a lot of challenges as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China and China's role in a time of economic crisis. Looking back 1 year after On Point was there, broadcasting from the heart of Shanghai, talking in April 09 with some of the Chinese thinkers we met in April 2008. Sun Jie, you were involved with Hillary Clinton's visit very recently to Beijing. Is there a new tone in U.S.-China relations at the end of this year with a new American president in the White House?
Yes, I think the message is very clear that the two countries need to manage the relationship very carefully. Also, Hillary mentioned that strategic economic dialogue should be continued, and also she also pointed out two particular areas that we can work together. One is clean energy. The second is energy saving or reduction issues. So that is two areas I think should be the focus of the new round of strategic economic dialogue.
And Feng Xinghai, we just wrapped up the G20 meeting in Europe. Your leader, Hu Jintao, was there. Do you see China getting the face, the respect, the clout that it deserves at this point in the international economy and governance, I guess, might even be the word there, Mr. Feng?
Well, we are quite happy with the result of the G20 meeting. China made a contribution of $40 billion to IMF. Mm-hmm. In turn, our voices are heard. Our push for international regulatory reforms were discussed. China, pretty much had a quite high profile in this meeting. Mm-hmm. So, we are a big economy and we should make contributions to solving international problems. And in turn, we should have our fair share in the decision-making of international institutions. I think we pretty much get what we want.
We've got a lot of callers with questions for you. Let's get one from Detroit, Michigan. CJ, you're on the air to Shanghai and Beijing. Hi, CJ.
Hi. In the 80s, we looked at Japan when we were in a recession, and we were thinking they had the answers. And now, lately, we've looked at China as though they have the answers. But what I see, perhaps, is that they're starting to ask the same questions around the difference between growth and sustainability. And on that note, the Shanghai Auto Show is coming up in a couple weeks. And one of our companies, our auto companies here, Ford Motor Company, has not taken any money from our government and is still looking towards some sustainability. And the way they're approaching that is globally. And I wonder if they could comment on their own auto industry that they're starting and a little bit about the importance of the Shanghai Auto Show.
Absolutely. CJ, thanks for your call. Feng Xinghai, you're in Shanghai. Lots of headlines out of China just in the last few days about China's plans to push forward in electric cars in particular, to try and maybe lead the world in that. We've all seen Detroit's troubles recently. How do you see China's role in the auto industry?
Well, it is a big industry in China already. And fortunately, we are still at a fairly early stage of our auto industry. And therefore, even in the midst of this slowdown, in the first 2 months in China, auto sales have actually gone up year on year. Now, so clearly this is a very important industry. But I don't think the Chinese industry, the auto industry, is going to lead the world anytime soon. In the traditional diesel and gasoline-powered auto area, I think China will still have a long way to go. Now, there's one company you mentioned, the Beyondi car company, which is producing a 100% electric-powered car. And there is potential there that if this technology becomes, cheap and widely available, this company can lead the world. That's possible. But, this is just they just started to produce an all-electric car. And I don't think you can make such a comfortable prediction that it will lead the world. I don't think that's possible at this point.
But the headline that we've read out of China is that Communist Party leaders have made a kind of policy decision to make that the goal, turning the country into a leading producer of hybrid and all-electric vehicles within 3 years. That is fast.
Well, it is a policy, yes. But, government
right.
policies are not always realized
sure.
in the end.
Right.
We've made these five-year plans, for dozens of years, mm-hmm. and not all of them have been fulfilled. But I think it's a laudable goal. I would encourage that auto company to make, and other auto companies in China, to make every effort to produce a viable electric car, in particular, in the midst of global climate warming and things like that. Yeah.
Mm. Of course, that electricity likely still to come, at least would currently, from coal-fired plants, maybe not in the cities.
Well, hopefully it's going to come from somewhere else.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's hope. Sunjay, let me ask you about the very big picture here. I was reading a commentary recently in the Washington Post talking about people looking at the U.S.-China relationship and worrying. China has accumulated all these U.S. dollars, trillion plus, that if China would sell off or stop buying U.S. bonds, I'm quoting here, this is from a Zachary Carabel essay, the American economy could sink even deeper, leaving us, the USA, like England at the end of World War II, a broke and broken hegemon dependent on an upstart power. Do you see that dynamic, Sunjay?
Not really. I know that the United States has become codependence with China, on the dollar mm-hmm. issues, because money is power anyway. And China becomes the biggest creditor of the United States, and the United States becomes the big debtor to other countries. That's really awkward. I think what China cares about, they should make sure that hard-earned money invested in the United States should be safe. Mm-hmm. I think there's internal debate among Chinese experts and policymakers whether China should continue to buy the U.S. government debt. I think the moving tendency is most of the Chinese experts agree that compared to euro, compared to Japanese yen, that U.S. dollar is still stable, still worth to be invested. Further invested. So I think the China will continue to buy, and that is sign for the future. So actually, China bought, over $10 billion last month.
Feng Shenghai, yes, in your job there. Yeah. I mean, it was specifically created to turn Shanghai into a leading international financial center.
No, I don't think just in terms of investing our foreign exchange reserves in U.S. Government bonds. Mm-hmm. I think from an investment point of view, it's pretty dumb to buy so much U.S. treasuries because clearly the U.S. dollar is not going to be worth as much as it is today, 10 years down the road. So we should diversify more in our investments. But the problem, of course, is that the U.S. capital markets is so huge and so liquid. And the other markets, the euro, the yen markets, are not that big and not that liquid. Mm-hmm. So we do not have a very good choice at this point. But I myself have advocated that we should invest more of these foreign exchange reserves in real assets, such as good companies' stocks, and the minerals and oils, all these real assets, instead of putting all these money into U.S. Treasury bonds.
What about turning the yuan, China's own currency, the renminbi, into a currency of choice? I know recently China's been making arrangements with countries around the world, from Asia to Argentina, to let them do business with China, not in dollars, but straight up in yuan.
In yuan, yes. That's a great idea. I fully support this idea. We have found a lot of our neighboring countries a willingness on their part to hold the RMB as a reserve currency. And they also want to do trade with us in RMB rather than in a foreign currency. And I think we should definitely encourage this trend and make the RMB more available and more used in international trade. I think that's clearly in China's interest, and obviously also in Shanghai's interest.
Now, if that catches on, what do you think, as an economist, U.S. trade economist, what does that mean for the United States?
Well, it takes time. It offers a good competition for the United States, which is good. The U.S. needs some competition. You should manage your policies better. Just to paraphrase President Obama, there's a collective failure on the U.S. Policymakers' side, and it's a big wake-up call to the United States. The U.S. can compete. There's no problem with that. It's just that you have to make better decisions.
You make the point loud and clear. We hear the bell ringing. Mark is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air to Shanghai and Beijing.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
It strikes me that the biggest fear that China probably must have, I would think, is fear of U.S. inflation, which, if it rises, it would devalue the long-term investment that they have in U.S. Treasury bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, they want to watch and make sure that inflation here doesn't go up, and we want to make sure that they don't pull their money out. It's almost like the U.S. and China have these levers that are so tightly integrated with each other and that control each other's economy. So decisions are going to have to be made by the politicians in both countries that aren't necessarily in line with domestic wishes, but, we're really so much in this together.
Absolutely.
It's going to be tough for people to understand that some decisions may not look the greatest to, the unions here or this or that interest, but really are in our interest in the long run, and vice versa.
Well, it's complicated to figure out what's in whose interest here, but Mark, that's a great point. Sun Jay, what about it? You mentioned the U.S. and China economic interdependence earlier, but does that limit China's scope for action here economically? Does it still have an interest in the United States being strong? And what about the inflation threat, Sun Jay?
The point I want to make is the Chinese people worry about the United States shouldn't send wrong messages. For example, when Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao warned the United States that he worried about the Chinese investment in the United States, and President Obama reassures the Chinese people that they should have absolute confidence in investing in the United States. Then after 2 weeks, the United States government began to print more money, you know, massive mm-hmm. printing of the U.S. dollars.
Right.
So that's a wrong message. I think that before you do that, the two governments should talk with each other, you know, to send a clear, should have some kind of a channel of communication before that massive printing. So that is the, what we call the future crisis management. The two countries should manage this economic interdependence well.
I guess in a way, hitting the on button on the printing press is some kind of message in itself, but it's not exactly a dialogue. Feng Shenhai, what about that? The U.S.
Yes.
Federal Reserve,
just
yes, indeed,
point.
Pumping out lots of...
the U.S. will succeed or fail largely because of U.S. itself. I mean, China plays a role, but it's simply wrong to say that, you know, somehow the U.S.'s recovery depends on China's cooperation in buying more U.S. treasuries. That's totally untrue. And the U.S.'s domestic policy, you know, things like printing money or so, the U.S. should not be consulting with China before making these decisions. I mean, that's
really
ridiculous.
I mean, even now when we're so tightly connected, around dollar flows?
Well, China certainly can help the U.S. in terms of making the treasury market smoother, you know, I mean, and that's also in China's interest, by the way. But I think it's an overstatement to say that somehow, you know, U.S.'s recovery depends on China cooperating with the U.S. I think that's overblown.
There's a kind of you're on your own, Buster, message from Shanghai. Let's get a call from Ocean in Boston. Hi, Ocean, you're on the air.
Hi, I can talk from the point of biotechnology.
Uh-huh.
Number one, China have more job than ever. If you lose your job in America, go to China if you have skill. Number two, at least you can teach English. Number two, China want to change the image. Instead of made in China, they want to be discovered in China. Number three, China have more people than any people, any country, right? It's more PhD and people hungry for science. And China respect scholar instead of business people. It's not only American children. They only watch movie, want to movie, stupid movie star and basketball and this kind of thing. They don't know interest in science. But China loves science. And number four, you can never starve in China, have tons of food. You're always eating all the time, unlike India. And number fifth, and you know what? China people, Chinese people all around the world, because earthquake, I was in earthquake. I was in Olympic, and also I was in Shanghai, give seminar for Fudan University, Peking University, teach people how to be successful. And you know what? The Chinese people, they pour together, come together, and donate money. And China said, we don't need the money, but we need the medicine. And in China, more than 300 million people are aging, more than America. They have money, but they need medicine. Money cannot buy. They can buy medicine, but they cannot buy the health.
Ocean, what do you think about this U.S.-China relationship going forward? Does it look like there's going to be good harmony here to you?
Very good for America, because China has the people, has the resources, and they have the government support. But they need American the innovation. They need American the brain. So it's really good for each other.
Ocean, thank you very much for calling. Sunjay, in the last year, how would you look at it? Do things look brighter for this relationship or more complicated?
I think the biggest question that we have to consider is whether this we have deepened our cooperation or whether we become open competitor with each other in terms of the helping restructure the international institutions, in terms of some other areas in Africa, in North Korea. So my general observation is that China has built up its confidence, and also China is willing to work with the United States, especially work with new president, work with new Congress.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China and China's role in a time of economic crisis, looking back 1 year after On Point was there, broadcasting from the heart of Shanghai, talking in April 09 with some of the Chinese thinkers we met in April 08. We're joined from Beijing by Sun Jie, one of China's top scholars of U.S.-China relations, teaches at Tsinghua University in Beijing. And from Shanghai, we're joined by Fang Shenghai, got his Ph.D. in economics at Stanford University in 1993. He's now Director General of the Office for Financial Services in the Shanghai Metropolitan Government, a big role in the world of Chinese finance. Let's get a call from Stephen in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on the air with our guests from China.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm sort of intrigued as China sort of in the last year or two tried to sort of position itself as the sort of dynamically modern ancient civilization. And this is more of a cultural question, not so much economic. I'm sort of curious how it's been sort of superseded or in some ways beaten at its own game by India in terms of sort of cachet and authenticity. And I don't know if it's a question of, you know, did Slumdog Millionaire trump the Olympics or it's just something that I to on the Western radar, that seemed to me how it's played out somewhat. And I was just curious whether or not either of the guests
We've got it. It's kind of a will of a wisp issue, not easy to get your hands around. But Sun Jie, let me ask you, when it comes to, you've got your finger on the pulse of how people around the world think. When it comes to our Mark asks, cultural cachet. How do you see China faring these days, maybe vis-a-vis India?
I went to India two months ago, mm-hmm. and I think the a lot of Chinese people, they don't pay much attention to India's Indian problem. And also, I think the I got a feeling when I visited there, Indian people, or Indian politicians, very much care about the Chinese rights. Some of them even treat China as a potential threat. So some people even want to build up a triangle dialogue of the United States, China, and India. What I want to say is, I think the two countries are different. People, if you follow the Indian model of development, maybe you should improve the efficiency, you know. And in China, some people argue that China is led by one-party dominant rule. So China created, you see the economic miracles over the past 30 years. So there are two paths in the economic development, two different things.
Maybe related to this, Fang Shenghai, there's been talk about the G20 and the G2. Zbigniew Brzezinski sort of raising this as China mm-hmm. and the U.S. can do it almost alone, can sort of lead. What about this sort of panoply?
First of all, on the China and India issue, China has a highly centralized system, mm-hmm. and it's very effective in mobilizing resources. That's why we have dealt with the massive earthquake very well. You know, we have hosted a spectacular Olympic, which will not be matched, you know, for many years to come by any countries. So this is our strength. You know, we build all these sort of spectacular infrastructure and so forth. And India is not good at these things. Let me tell you that. Now, India has another system. It's a decentralized. It's a sort of more market based system. So it has its own advantages. And India has a lot better software industry. It has more creative industry and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So each country has its own strengths and weaknesses. And you cannot compare an orange and apple in that sense.
Regarding the
G2.
Yes, please.
Regarding the G2. In terms of economic size, yes, the U.S. and China are number one and almost number two now, China. Right? It's slightly behind Japan, but the growth rate is so much bigger, faster than Japan. And in terms of the marginal contribution to world growth, we have surpassed Japan a long time ago. So in that sense, U.S. and China largely determine the world's recovery in this downturn. And if U.S. and China can coordinate well, yes, it largely determines the world's recovery. So in that sense, it's true. But of course, the world has a lot of other problems, and G2 is not sufficient to solve all these problems.
Let me ask you about the fundamental dynamic of that economic relationship. And essentially, as China has been rising, growing so fast, it's been China manufacturing and exporting, the U.S. Buying and borrowing.
Yes.
Export-led growth from the China side. Now, in the midst of this crisis, does that look sustainable, or does China have to figure out a different basis for its economic growth?
That's a very good question. Anthony Kuhn, your reporting China, mentioned this problem at the beginning. China has been growing very fast, predicated on export growth, and we've built up a massive capacity geared for exports. Now all of a sudden, exports are gone. So our growth model has to undergo a fundamental change, and that is, how do you create domestic demand and you have the supply that can meet these domestic demand at a efficient price? Now, this is a huge challenge.
Supply is a problem? I would have thought China was pumping out plenty of everything.
No, the right supply, for example, we've been making all these, Christmas trees a lot, right? And we export to the U.S., but, the Chinese people don't use Christmas trees.
Yeah.
So you have to shift the capacity into producing something that the Chinese people want and at a relatively low price, for example. And this is a big adjustment. It's a huge adjustment. So we are undergoing this adjustment. So I think China is going to have a few years of quite slow growth rate. Although we are still growing at about 6%. I mean, you think 6% is very high, but in our country, 6% is very low. 6-8% is very low.
Yeah, in your phase of development. Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Hague. Hague, you're on the air.
Hello. Sanjay and Tom. I'm calling to put a little perspective, which is a more worldwide perspective on China and the United States relations and also economic growth. China has a history of large consumption, being the largest population in the world, and also with the massive buildup of Chinese productivity and production modes, which Sanjay just referred to. The questions in the future years are of whether even 6% growth is reasonable expectation and necessary, that the Chinese government seems to have predicated that it needs or wants this size of growth. We're in a worldwide recession. China needs to look at other markets besides the United States and also needs to supply its own population, which is an enormous population. There are some negative aspects of the economic discussion here, that we have this preemptive decision that we must continue to grow and have economic growth at a rapid rate. It is inappropriate for the conditions of the times.
Let me ask our guests about that. Feng Xinghai, let me come first to you, if I may. If I recall correctly, you and I chatted a year ago in Shanghai, and one of the things you said that really struck me was that, yes, there's an environmental price to Chinese growth, but China is going to grow, you said, in a very determined way, sort of regardless of that environmental price, until it is a fully affluent nation. You still have a lot of poor there, even if it takes decades. How do you look at that now?
No, I mean, the caller is right. We cannot rely so much on falling demand for our growth, as it has been for a number of years. We have to rely more on our own demand. So we have to look at our own demand and look into our own people for growth. But growth is still paramount in China, because if we cannot afford to grow at 2 or 3%, I mean, that slow growth will put the country into a predicament, and a lot of problems will kind of prop up. So we still have to grow, but we have to grow more based on our own demand. Now, environmental issues, of course, they are very important. I mean, I don't think we should grow at whatever environmental cost. That's ridiculous, because if you cannot drink water, what's the point of making a few more bucks, right? Because you're hurting yourself all the time. So environmental issues certainly is very important to us as well.
Sunjay, our time begins to trickle down here. I want to be sure and touch on a couple of other fronts. One, military. The U.S. Pentagon said recently in its big report that China is looking for technology and weapons to counter the traditional advantages of U.S. forces, and that secrecy, as they described it, around China's military goals creates the potential for miscalculation on both sides. You know, we saw one little example, almost humorous, in the South China Sea when the U.S. ship, the Impeccable, was sort of surrounded by some Chinese ships recently, U.S. using its water cannon and the Chinese sailors taunting the U.S. ship. What did you see about U.S.-China military relations, and what about the Pentagon's warning here, Sunjay?
I think both Chinese Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi and Hillary met in Washington tried to calm down the incident, the nervous caused by the Nanhai incident. I think there are some of the military exchange and has already taken place. For example, some of the retired American general came to China and have some kind of a scenario and analysis. And also, we're talking about the philosophy of using nuclear powers, you know, something like that. So I think China used to send a high-level military professional to Harvard, to some other American universities, for some kind of training program. We should encourage this kind of exchange of military personnel to make sure that they understand each other's philosophy, each other's military strategies better. So that's why the Pentagon always emphasized the key words called transparency. But for the Chinese military professionals, they understand that the United States owns, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 nuclear warheads, and China probably only have 100, you know, something like that. It is unbalanced warfare. So Chinese people will pay more attention on crisis management. In any case, I think we should encourage the military dialogue.
Fang Xinghai, what about the North Korean missile just over this weekend? Reports are that it flew some hundreds of miles, was not successful if it was the aim to get into orbit, we're told. But the very fact of them firing off this missile with their nuclear program had Japan very upset, the United States, some talking in a pretty upset way. What's China's view of the North Korean missile test been?
Well, I'm not an expert on this issue. I would rather refer this question to the professor.
Sunjay?
I think Chinese policy statements is very clear. We would encourage denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And also, I think China has warned, passed a message to North Korea that should be careful. And certainly, I think this is more related to U.S.-North Korea relationship. I think the North Korea has rejected the food assistance. So that is a dangerous sign. I think Obama should send another special envoy or special messenger to Pyongyang, try to talk to North Korea directly.
But China's right there on North Korea's border. Doesn't China have the clout, the leverage to be more influential with Pyongyang?
Not necessarily. So a lot of Americans think that China has the leverage. But when the kids grow up, they don't listen to their, you know, family members. So I think there's a lot of very complex situation there.
Fang Xinghai, obviously the global economy is in huge flux right now. Americans are looking at the debt that they hold and thinking, okay, how do we begin to change things to pay this back and to reset this balance? If the United States has to become a bigger exporter in order to get on a more even keel, do you see China as a big market for American exports, Mr. Fang?
Clearly, yes. Yeah, the U.S. has to produce more, consume less, and export more. And then, you know, as a result, it can save more and to pay back all these debts. Now, China represents a huge export market for the United States. You know, in high tech, in airplanes, in nuclear equipment, nuclear power equipment, and even agriculture. I mean, the U.S. is one of the most productive countries in agriculture. It can start to export to China a lot more. And, you know, as I said, you know, China is, has to sort of find new domestic demands, and we have to have the right supply to meet these new domestic demand. And the U.S. is far ahead of many, many other countries in terms of meeting new demands of a rising, you know, growing country. So the U.S. has a lot of role to play. I mean, even when I look around Shanghai, for example, and I go to Starbucks every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, Chinese domestic producers cannot produce coffees like Starbucks do. So, you know, so Starbucks has a big role to play in China. And McDonald's, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken, all these things. Yes, one, you know, the U.S. has a lot of role to play in China.
But we just heard recently
about the argument about tea house and the Starbucks, whether Chinese people love to drink tea rather than
certainly a lot of people are drinking coffee. If you come to Shanghai, yeah, go to a Starbucks, chances are it's full.
Yeah, I don't know if we can balance the trade accounts on Starbucks and McDonald's,
Starbucks?
But perhaps we'll see. We'll throw a little, maybe throw
US
a little Boeing
a lot of
in
other
there.
Things.
Right, right. Well, I want to thank both of you again, first for being with us in Shanghai a year ago and your perspective there, and for being good enough to be back with us on the other side of all that's happened in the year since then. We appreciate your time and your observations. Sun Jie, joining us from Beijing at Tsinghua University, thank you very much for being with us, Professor Sun.
My pleasure.
And Feng Xinghai in Shanghai, always great to speak with you. Thank you very much for your time with us today.
Good to be here.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.